from New York, it's The Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin with our latest on health and healing, how to live a longer life, what to do if you have prostate cancer, what to do if you are without purpose in life, and how that can impact your aging brain. Exercise being linked to improved erectile and sexual function in men. So it wasn't the Viagra, it was exercise or lack thereof. And today is commentary day. I've written some commentaries I'll be sharing, plus I'm going to be sharing commentaries from other individuals. And I will leave time today for you to call in and share your thoughts on the commentaries that I'll be putting before you. I try to select a variety of topics that hopefully most people in the audience will find of interest. I just find the mainstream media is lacking in the essential issues. For example, on last evening's 60 Minutes, they did a segment talking about essential minerals, minerals that we make a lot of our important things from computers to weaponry systems and cell phones, that the Chinese have had a market on this. So then it was looking at China as if it were the enemy of us and a national security risk because it had more minerals than we do. I would look at it differently. Also, there was the issue of a Christian community in Iraq that had been devastated. The entire village of thousands of people, 7,000 people, moved. But one of the leaders of the Christian movement in Iraq, that is one of the oldest Christian communities in the world, made a statement I've heard so many times. And I'd like for us to think about this for a moment. That the problem was he was only able to get out of there with 5 minutes notice, and they only could take like five books. And one of the books was 500 years old, but he had 1,000-year-old books he couldn't take, and those were all confiscated and burned by ISIS. Why? He knew, everyone knew, that they were under siege and would likely be taken. Why was there no pre-planning? Why was there no assertiveness? Just like when you hear the people in California say, and I was actually out there when this was happening, where they say, oh, we lost everything. Well, didn't you know there was a fire in the area? Yeah. Couldn't you have rented a trailer, taken your important belongings and move them to a safer place or to a fireproof storage area, which you could rent? Yeah, but you didn't. We like to believe that when we lose everything, it's instantaneous. We literally couldn't do anything except run out of a house. With the exception of some situations, that's rarely the case. We do know that we're in harm's way. So why don't we do something about it? This man knew weeks in advance ISIS was coming in that direction and was moving fast and was not being stopped. Why didn't he take these valuable books then and get them out? I just see this all the time. I'm going to address that. But we begin with something that's concerned me for some time. I see our bureaucracies growing at an exponential rate and not serving the needs of the commons, not serving the American public's needs. They become self-serving at a certain point. You start seeing behind the scenes that they're inefficient, but extremely profitable. And once you've gamed the system, once you have a new company and you're getting money for whatever you're doing, whether it's surveillance or private prisons, or whether you're doing something for the forestry service, it never ends, and no one ever questions, should we still have this? Do we still need it? Everything emergency becomes permanent, and we pay for this. And yet we do not have money for that which could help us all on so many levels, like rebuilding the infrastructure of the United States. It would take to completely rebuild everything, $3 trillion. But that means everything, every bridge and tunnel and infrastructure that is necessary. But let's say if we only did part of that, where would we get the money? When every time we turn around, they want to take money from these special funds or needs and give it to these bureaucracies and special private contractors. This is the latest study from the Natural Society, Anthony Gucciardi. Quote, the Institute, by the way, he's referring to the Institute of Medicine, which is the government's official medical overseeing body. It is the court of last resort when anything is involving medicine in the United States, in our healthcare system, finds waste of $750 billion per year. Now, let's just go down through the numbers. These are their numbers. This would mean, quote, over $75 billion is just straight up fraud. $55 billion is lost due to lack of preventative education. An opportunity means we don't tell people how to prevent disease in the United States. I mean, there are some people who do. There's a small number of radio programs and magazines that encourage people to make healthy choices. But that isn't in the mainstream. So as a result, a lot of people, unfortunately, do not understand that things they're consuming are going to be deadly. But we could educate them. We choose not to. $190 billion in unnecessary administrative and paperwork that we do not need. They decided we don't need this. $210 billion is spent on unnecessary services, including repeating tests over and over and over again for no reason. $130 billion is spent every year on tests and services that were performed in a way that made them even more expensive than necessary, such as using hospital facilities for no reason during a test. Giving an example, a bag of saline water, just plain salt water, that is used commonly in hospitals, costs about no more than $10. They can charge up to $900 for that. So hospitals, including the not-for-profit hospitals, are very profitable. And then you start realizing, wow, why? This year we will spend over $3.3 trillion on health care. That's just incredible. And yet, 30 cents of every dollar that we spend is purely wasted. And from my perspective, that means that we could be using that money to help create a single-payer health insurance. With just what is lost in 1 year, we could see that every single American had full coverage with no deductibles. Because right now, part of the game is you may be covered under Obamacare, but your premiums have doubled in many cases, and the amount of copay or deductible is so high that a family would sometimes pay $5,000 to $7,000 for a deductible. So before the insurance kicks in, you have to pay that amount of money. So how many American families have an extra $5,000 to $7,000 sitting in a bank account so when someone gets sick, they can pay it? And mind you, that's just for the first pay. If you have to go back later for additional medical coverage, you have to start all over again. So since when does someone go in and one time only gets helped and they never have to return to the doctor or hospital again? No, most conditions are chronic, which means that the number one problem financially for those who don't have homes is medical cost. So all we've done is make the insurance industry extraordinarily rich. And so one of the stocks of the company was about $13 or $14 before Obamacare. Now it's at $106 a share because of all this, what they call skin in the game, making the American public pay more. But are they getting more? The answer is no. Are they getting better care, creating longer and healthier lives? The answer is no. The medicine we're getting is more toxic, more dangerous, and we're getting more of it. We're over-medicated and not healthy. So at some point, if we took the politics and ideology out of this and just ask a simple question, what is required for a person to live a healthy life and a longer life. Then you set up an educational program unbiased by special interest groups to show people this is how you live a longer and healthier life. Now, there are over 1,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature just on the Mediterranean diet. Now, that's not a vegan diet, but it's close. And there are a lot of things that the average vegan wouldn't be doing that would allow them to live a longer life if they followed a Mediterranean diet. For example, if you've ever been to the Mediterranean, you know that people take their time. They don't rush. That they enjoy the company of friends and family when they're eating. That they take a siesta afterwards. That it's very common to see all the businesses in a community close down between noon and 4. Then they go back and they work from 4 until 7 at night. Then they have a light meal in the evening. And then they socialize. I remember when I was going into Verona to see a concert, an opera. And I had driven that day from Venice. And it was wonderful. I couldn't find a seat because it was packed. There were 25,000 people in this old amphitheater. But I could still hear everything perfectly, even standing on the steps. And afterwards, in these wonderful streets, there were all these restaurants that were very old. And there it was, 11 o'clock at night, and people dining and socializing. Everything was relaxed. Nothing was rushed. So if you're a person following that lifestyle, there are many conditions that we suffer from, like diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease in the United States, that we would be far less likely to have in those cultures, taking on some qualities. But we don't look at anyone else in the world for insight. We believe we have it all here because we spend the most money. We have the so-called best experts. The trouble is our experts are not the best, and we don't have a long life or a healthy life to show for it. So that's important in this discussion. So if you're going to waste $750 billion and you're not going to change any of it because the people who are making that money are the bureaucracies and they keep expanding and they give huge amounts of money every year to lobbyists who then make sure that nothing changes. So even though we acknowledge, the Institute of Medicine acknowledges we're wasting three-quarters of $1 trillion, we won't change anything. So knowing that our government is completely corrupt, should never be trusted, has lied to us, looks at us as if we're the enemy, and then it falls upon us to make the changes that we need. And the good news is there are tens of millions of Americans making positive changes every day, and that's good. But at some point, just realize how wasteful the government is and the bureaucracies and private interests that feed off that. And that's just one section of the government. That's not the military-industrial complex. That's not the oil cartels, the nuclear cartels. That's just medicine. Now, speaking of medicine, Australia is going through its own witch hunts for any parent that chooses not to vaccinate their child because they've looked at the science and find the science does not support the safety and efficacy of vaccines. That's the irony. Those who do the most research, whether they're doctors, nurses, or lay people, have come to a decision that they want a freedom of choice to make that is not what everyone else that doesn't look for any proof, just goes ahead as blind belief. So they ask one of the people listening from Australia, would I address this? So each day this week, I'll be addressing some part of the vaccine issue. I want to share a little bit from Dr. Gary Coles, a medical doctor, on this. And a German study showed that 8,000 non-vaccinated children, newborn to 19 years of age, showed that compared to vaccinated children, they were 200 to 500% more diseases and more disorders than the unvaccinated children. The complete data, there were charts, and I read the charts from the National German KIGS Health Study of the Children in General. And then you take a look at the charts and you think, wow, Well, if someone from The Nation magazine or Mother Jones or MSNBC is advocating for, as they are, for vaccinating, why aren't they studying these statistics? Because these are good quality, independent, and national statistics, but no one's using this information in their arguments or debates. Let me put this a different way. No study of health outcomes of vaccinated people versus unvaccinated people has ever been conducted in the United States by the CDC or any other agency in the 50 years or more on accelerating schedules of vaccines. Now over 50 doses of 14 vaccines given before kindergarten, 26 doses in the first year. And so we don't have the proof that we claim we do for the safety of vaccines. Now, separately, let me just give you an example of the science that's there that the pro-vaccine journalists are not looking at. This is the latest, volume 215, article ID 573701. It's 13 pages long, and it is mitochondria protected by pretreatment with glutathione precursor and acetylcysteine. And it's in the Journal of Toxicology. Because one whole area of science shows that virtually all vaccines, no exceptions, are toxic. And then it's a matter of how toxic, since no two people have the same susceptibility. And the fact that one person ends up with obvious toxicological implications, another person may not, and we're not looking at the vaccine's toxic reactions. All we're looking at is, were their antibodies created? Now, 99.9% of all people given a vaccine never have an immunological test to see does it work. Now, let me explain this, because this is really at the heart of the debate. If I suggested everyone in this audience take 100 milligrams a day of vitamin C, and you did, and at the end of a year, I said, what percentage of you came down with a cold or flu? And it was 20%. I could not then say that vitamin C at 100 milligrams a day prevented 80% of the people from getting a flu or cold. I would have no model of actual testing every one of those people to see their immune systems and their exposure to viruses. Many people wouldn't have even come into contact with a virus that would have given the cold or flu, and they may be doing other things that would have contributed to a stronger immune system that could have prevented the flu. The same identical argument can be used when it comes to vaccines. If you want to take 1,000 children and you vaccinate them, and you take another 1,000 children you don't, and you cross-match them, and then every single 3 months you test them for the entire spectrum of exposures to antigens, meaning foreign agents that are in the body, virus and bacteria that could have contributed, and the incidence of disease, the duration of diseases, the mortality of disease over a five-year period, then at least you have some data. That test has never once been done. So let's face it, when your kid is given a vaccine, when you go to the pharmacy and get a vaccine, does anyone actually do a level of antibody response? The answer is never. So then how can they say that everyone gets a positive antibody reaction that protects them? There's no science behind it. None. And so that is why it should be challenged. Now, here is an article. Increased susceptibility to thimerosal-induced mitochondrial dysfunction in a subset of autistic lymphoblastic cell lines. It's a good study. And it shows an association between autism spectrum disorder, oxidative stress, and ingredients like mercury in vaccines. You would think that someone would pay attention to this before they went off and said vaccines are safe and there's no harm. Because mercury is one of, quote, several environmental toxicants that have been found to have an association with development of autism spectrum disorder. That's directly from the article. So how could someone say there's no association between vaccines and autism? Right here in the Journal of Toxicology, they're saying exactly that. So that's where we have just selective cherry-picking of science, and it's bad. One more thing on vaccines today, and that is, this was from Dr. Robert Rowan. testimony at the Vaccine World Summit, as reported by Ethan Huff, Global Research. Quote, vaccine so-called science at its most typically presented to the public is a hollow house of cards propped up by deception and lies. Ask any doctor out there to show you even just one all-cause morbidity and mortality study proving the safety and efficacy of vaccines, and you'll never see it because such a study is non-existent. John Hopkins graduate Dr. Robert Rowan has been investigating the claims surrounding the safety and efficacy of vaccines for many years, and his undeniable conclusion is that vaccines don't work and are not safe. The measures by which the modern medical profession claims that vaccines are safe and effective don't hold water. And quote from Dr. Rowan. In China, well over 90% of large populations are getting vaccinated, and allegedly they have immunity, and they measure immunity in immunoglobulins. It turns out that that's not a good way to measure immunity because people with immunoglobulins are getting measles. It just doesn't seem to work, end quote. And by the way, vaccines, if they do work, only provide temporary immunity at best and come with a high risk of permanent health damage. Remember, if you got the measles vaccine and you didn't get the measles, that is absolutely zero proof, zero, not a scintilla of proof that it was the vaccine that kept you from getting the measles. You may not have been exposed to the measles unless you have antibodies, and the antibodies are at an adequate level to show that they're specific for the measles and the specific strain of measles, and the antibodies are the specific strain of antibodies for the specific strain of measles, then you have no scientific proof. Today, speaking on these issues is like speaking with alchemists from the Middle Ages. Where is the honesty in the intellectual discussions within science? They're just not existent today. A widespread misconception holds that vaccines are the only way to attain immunity and avoid infectious disease, but quite the contrary is actually true, as vaccines only provide, at best, temporary immunity, while simultaneously and significantly increasing the risk of immune dysfunction and behavioral disorders and other major health problems. Quote from Dr. Rowan. There's a graph of how these communicable diseases have fallen since the introduction of vaccines, and a corresponding parallel identical rise in chronic immune dysfunction like asthma, arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and others. No one has ever done an all-cause morbidity and mortality study on the effectiveness and safety of vaccines, and that's why I've called for since 1990 when I first got alerted to the situation. Chronic disease has skyrocketed among children alongside massive additions to vaccine schedule. Dr. Rowan cited a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2010 that highlights a doubling in the rate of chronic health conditions among children between the ages of 1994 and 2006 from 12.8% to 26.6%. This directly corresponds with substantial increases in the number of vaccines added to the government's vaccine schedule. And another study he references demonstrated that infant death rates are higher among vaccinated children. Quote, do we want to be trading a few less problems with measles or other illnesses which are far more benign? Mumps is benign. Chickenpox is benign. German measles, rubella is totally benign unless it's caught by a pregnant woman. Do we want to be trading a few less complications from that for a doubling of chronic immune disease that we treat? End quote. Quote, I'd rather have lifelong immunity that deals with getting a flu shot when I'm 18 months old and then getting temporary immunity at best and then having it wear off later and be far more susceptible to a problem because these are diseases that you don't want to get when you're an adult. If vaccines are safe and effective, then go get your vaccines. I have no problem with that. But the reality is that 26% risk of chronic intractable untreatable disease or autism for your child is also there. And that's from Dr. Rowland. Now, last night, before I go there, I want to tell you about vitamin D because, there are thousands of studies on vitamin D and yet Americans are not getting enough. This is from the University of South Carolina. They described a presentation at the National Meeting of the American Chemical Society. What they found is this. If a tumor is present in a prostate biopsy, a pathologist grades its aggressiveness on a scale known as the Gleason grading system. Tumors with Gleason scores of 7 or above are considered aggressive and likely to spread. Generally, that's when the surgeon suggests removing the prostate gland or radiation therapy. In contrast, prostate tumors with Gleason scores of 6 and below are less aggressive and in some cases may cause no symptoms or health problems for the duration of a person's life. In cases of low-grade prostate cancer, many urologists do not even treat the disease, but instead do what they call an active surveillance. And what they say here is, quote, the cure, meaning surgery radiation, is probably worse than the disease. So they wait a year and then do another biopsy and see where the patient stands. However, what they have now found is that vitamin D supplements during a 60-day waiting period would affect the prostate cancer. Previous research has shown that when men with low-grade prostate cancer took vitamin D supplements for a year, 55% of them showed a decrease in Gleason scores or even complete disappearance of their tumors compared to their biopsies the year before. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. In a new randomized controlled clinical trial, his team assigned the men undergoing elective prostate surgery either to a group that received 4,000 units of vitamin D a day or a placebo group that didn't receive vitamin D. And the men's prostate glands were removed and examined 60 days later. And preliminary results from the study indicate that many of the men who received vitamin D showed improvements in their prostate tumors, whereas the tumors in the placebo group did not. So, what's the takeaway message? Cancer is associated with inflammation, especially the prostate gland. Vitamin D turns off inflammation within the prostate gland. So, if you want to prevent prostate inflammation, take your vitamin D. If you have cancer, definitely take your vitamin D. From Rush University Medical Center, having a strong sense of direction in your life and focusing the meaning of your life on a daily basis can actually impact the aging brain and allow you to be healthier. So you get better blood flow, and I think that's partly because when you're creating solutions, when you're looking at doing things that excite you, when you're working on something, whether it's a hobby or learning something, a new adventure in life, you actually increase blood flow and you lessen the likelihood of what are called infarcts, which are contributing to dementia, especially when they're small. What is called a mini stroke or a micro stroke. So get with something that gives you passion and you have joy in it and you can live a longer life. And for men who've had erectile dysfunction, this is from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. They found that men who exercise more have better erectile and sexual function regardless of race. And that's very important. Quote, this study is the first to link the benefits of exercise in relation to improved erectile and sexual function in a racially diverse group of patients. So I suggest doing aerobic for 45 minutes to an hour, 5 days a week, and resistance as well. Also, from our health section, naps. What are called power naps? This is from Saarland University in Germany. Quote, generations of school children have gone to bed the night before a math exam or a vocabulary test with their algebra book or vocabulary notes tucked under their pillow in the hope that the knowledge would somehow be magically transferred into their brains while they slept. They were not completely taken in by superstitious beliefs. Has now been demonstrated by a team of neuropsychologists at the university who have shown that even a brief sleep can significantly improve retention of learning material in memory. That's good news. So what it is, it's memory performance improves in those who do daily naps. So for students, the idea would be to study something, read something, and then take a nap. And that puts it into the brain, in the memory. And then when you're awake, and you don't have to take a long nap, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, these are little power naps. They can make a difference. Also, can olives help guard against dementia? Well, the Mediterranean diet has been heralded as a boon to health and as an effective protection against a variety of maladies, including dementia. A new study looks at the ability of a very specific part of the diet, olives, protect against neurological symptoms like memory loss. Now, mind you, everywhere in the Mediterranean, they have olive oil and olives. Olives are very common food there, and they have a large variety of olives that you don't see in the United States. And researchers were working on this, and what they found was, yes, it does make a difference. There are power nutrients that impact the mitochondria, the nerve cells, which change in Alzheimer's, and that olives and olive oil diminishes dementia. So that's good news. So if you are over the age of 40, make sure you're taking extra virgin organic olive oil and eating olives. I suggest eating 8 olives a day. And you eat different ones, green olives, black olives, red olives, all different types. Also, a good study published in the Journal of Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics reports the discovery of Washington State University researchers of a mechanism of the omega-3 fatty acids, remember you can get that from your flaxseed, in reducing prostate cancer cell growth and metastasis. And so this was done and also shown at the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. So get your omega-3s in. And coenzyme Q10 in the latest study prevents heart failure. This was a good study, and it's a study out of Denmark. It showed that Q10 drastically lowered deaths related to heart failure. How's that possible? By 50%, scientists recruited 420 heart failure patients with later stages of heart failure and monitored their conditions for 2 years. These patients were assigned to take 100 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 3 times a day or a placebo. They were tracked for major cardiovascular events, and according to the results, supplementation decreased the risk of major cardiovascular disease by 50%. How about that? Now, I would have suggested magnesium and hawthorn and carnitine and PPQ, all of which also make a difference. So imagine taking all that, and I wouldn't have someone, if I was counseling someone, they had major heart disease, I wouldn't be suggesting 100 milligrams, but a lot more. And finally, drinking diet soda leads to weight gain. Not that this should be that surprising this audience, but to the average person, it is. The Journal of the American Geriatric Society, the research was done there, and they found that diet sodas, we're talking about diet sodas now, not your regular sugar soda. Quote, the popular weight loss beverage may have zero calories, but research is continuously showing that the drink is a weak weight loss tool. In fact, a recent study has actually linked diet soda consumption to an increase in waistlines. In a striking dose-response relationship, increasing the diet soda was associated with escalating abdominal obesity, a potential pathway for cardiometabolic risk in the aging population. So, they looked at 700 white Latino people, tracked them for 9 years. Stay off the diet sodas, stay off all sodas, and you help yourself with that weight. And one last thing here, and that is turmeric. Now, turmeric we know is that wonderful spice in curry. But now there's good information presented by GreenMedInfo and Sarah G that turmeric's smart kill properties put chemotherapy and radiation to shame. Quote, the ancient Indian spice turmeric strikes again. A new study finds turmeric extracts selectively and safely killing cancer stem cells in a way that chemo and radiation cannot. A groundbreaking new study published in the journal Anti-Cancer Research reveals that one of the world's most extensively researched and promising natural compounds for cancer treatment, the primary polyphenol in the ancient spice turmeric, known as curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N, has the ability to selectively target cancer stem cells, which are the root of cancer malignancy, while having no toxic effect on normal stem cells. Titled Curcumin and Cancer Stem Cells, Curcumin has asymmetrical effects on cancer normal stem cells. The study describes the wide range of molecular mechanisms. So, the takeaway message is, if you want to prevent cancer, take curcumin. If you have cancer, makes all the difference in the world to use curcumin. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break, come back, and get into some commentaries. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world who are listening. And by the way, we have reestablished my Facebook page, which was taken down last week, so it could be changed over. And we have thousands upon thousands of articles available for people, and all told from the different interconnecting sites, about 20,000 people at a given moment can take a look at it. And we have a lot of people looking, but anyone who was on it before, you have to go back up and friend it to get in on again. I'm trying to put at least 200 important articles from around the world up there every day on progressive themes and a wide variety of themes. So it's a good source of free information on inspiring thought. So you just go to Gary Noll Facebook. From our environmental section today from Jennifer Francis. The melting Arctic in weird weather. The plot thickens. Now, many of you, I'm sure you saw the legislator who heads the environmental committee in Congress. He is a climate denier. And he holds up a snowball saying, you know, yeah, global warming, and here's a snowball. And we're seeing some of the worst Arctic weather ever. So then the argument should be, if we have all this snow and cold, then we couldn't have global warming, which means that all the people yelling about global warming are wrong. Nothing could be further from the truth. You've heard me many times in this program say that we had about 13,000 extreme weather events last year, meaning extreme is the hottest day, the coldest day, the most snow, the most drought in a given area. So you can have extremes. And severe drought and abnormally warm conditions are right now continuing in the West, with the first ever rain-free January in San Francisco ever. And bitter cold hangs tough over the upper Midwest and Northeast and New England. We just finished being buried in a seemingly endless string of snowy nor'easters over the last month. Yes, droughts, cold, and snowstorms have happened before, but the persistence of this pattern over North America, it's climate change at work. But for the person, the meteorologist who comes on, the Sean Hannity show, because he has him on to talk about how we really don't have global warming? Yes, we do. And the reason that you have these extremes, it's the jet stream. Now, this is a little technical, so I'll try to make it as simple as possible. And that is, the jet stream is a fast river of wind right up there where the jets fly that circumnavigates the northern hemisphere. And rather than circling in a relatively straight path, the jet stream has meandered more in north-south waves. In the west, it's been bulging northward since December 2013, and a pattern dubbed the Ridiculously Resilient Ridge by meteorologists. Now, in the east, we've seen its southern-dipping counterpart, which I call the Terribly Tenacious Trough. Now, these long-lived shifts from the polar stream typical pattern have been responsible for some of the worst weather this winter, with cold Arctic winds blasting everywhere from Chicago to New York City for weeks at a time. We know that climate change is increasing the odds of extreme weather, such as heat waves and droughts and unusually heavy rain, but it's making these sticky jet stream patterns more common also. Now, the jet stream is a dastardly complex creature, and figuring out what makes it tick has challenged atmospheric scientists since it was discovered about 75 years ago. Even more elusive is figuring out how climate change will affect it. You see, jet streams exist because of differences in air temperature. In the case of the polar jet stream, which is responsible for most of the weather we experience around the middle latitudes of the northern hemisphere, it's the cold Arctic butting against warmer areas in the south that drives it. Anything that affects that temperature difference will affect the jet stream. This is where climate change comes in. The Arctic is warming much faster than elsewhere. That Arctic mid-latitude temperature difference, consequently, is getting smaller. And the smaller differential in temperatures is causing the west-to-east winds in the jet to weaken. Strong jets tend to blow straight west-to-east. Weaker jets tend to wander more in kind of like a drunken north-south path, increasing the likelihood of wavy patterns like the one we've just all been through this past winter. When the jet stream's waves grow larger, they tend to move eastwards more slowly, which means the weather they generate also moves more slowly, creating more persistent weather patterns. So these are just some of the natural fluctuations, such as El Nino and others are related to increasing greenhouse gases. We do know, however, that the Arctic is changing in a wholesale way and at a pace that makes even Arctic scientists queasy. Take sea ice, for example. In only 30 years, its volume has declined by 60%, which is causing ripple effects throughout the ocean and the atmosphere and the ecosystem, both within the Arctic and beyond. To study the effects of Arctic change on weather patterns, we have good measurements of atmospheric temperatures and winds going back to the late 1970s when satellites started providing data, and pretty good measurements back to the late 1940s. So, you have to look at the waviness of the jet stream and whether it's behaving differently since the Arctic started its rapid warm-up about 20 years ago. Because the upper atmosphere is such a cacophony of swirling winds, however, measuring changes in the jet stream's waviness is tricky. It's not a metric system that's traditionally used. So the study has been to find ways of measuring the waviness and determine whether any changes are related to the rapid Arctic warming, and that's what has been done. So a number of recent studies have found what appears to be a solid connection between sea ice loss in an area north of Western Russia during the fall and a rash of abnormally cold winters in Central Asia. The loss of sea ice favors a northward bulge in the jet stream, which strengthens surface high pressure in the east. That shift pumps cold Arctic air southward into Central Asia. Other studies suggest that Arctic warming in summer leads to a split jet stream, or two separated rivers of wind, which tends to trap the waves. Those stationary waves cause weather conditions to remain stuck for long periods of time, and hence you get extreme heat waves, extreme drought, or extreme rain over North America and Eurasia. So this has been published in Environmental Research Letters. That is simply a different way of looking at what is causing all this, to bring some semblance of rational argument to the debate. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm looking at the clock. I'm afraid we're not going to have enough time to take open calls, but we'll end today with the latest on Carnegie Institute's Caldera Comes Clean on Chemtrails by Bob Fitrakis. Quote, noted climate scientist Ken Caldera of the Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford University has finally popped the question in an article entitled One Known Way to Cool the Earth in the current issue, or it wasn't current, it would have been a couple weeks ago, of USA Today. Quote, there is basically only one way known to cool the Earth rapidly. It is to reflect more of the sun's warming rays back into space. End quote. What will it take to do this? According to Caldera, only, quote, a small fleet of airplanes could do what large volcanoes do, create a layer of small particles high in the atmosphere that scatters incoming sunlight back to space. Cooling the Earth this way could be fast, cheap, and easy. End quote. The reality is that the United States government has been spraying for well over two decades and in plain view while attacking anyone pointing it out. They've been making a chemical haze of clouds and putting up sunscreen in the sky. Small white planes, some of them associated with the Battelli Memorial Institute, have been creating clouds in a crisscross pattern in the sky. Worrying about chemtrails is often derided as a tinfoil hat conspiracy, but transparency also broke out when former Congressman Dennis Kucinich actually introduced a bill referring to the elimination of chemtrails back in 2002. In December 2001, I had written an article called Stormy Weather, the government's top secret efforts to control Mother Nature. In the story, I quoted Caldera, then a scientist at Lawrence Livermore Labs, who admitted that he had conducted the original computer modeling for the use of chemtrails like aluminum oxide to fight global warming. He told me at the time, quote, we originally did the study to show that this problem should not be done, end quote. He alluded to possible negative health effects from using massive chemical spraying for weather modification. At the time, the leading promoter of this, quote, better living through chemistry approach to global warming remediation was Edward Teller. Now, the father of the H-bomb and grand promoter of Atoms for Peace, Teller spent his last few years advocating aerial spraying to counter global warming before he died in 2003. In April 24, 2002, the New York Times reported that Teller, quote, has promoted the idea of manipulating the Earth's atmosphere to counteract global warming. Two scientists from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, acknowledged that planes were already spraying barium salt polymer fibers, aluminum oxide, and other chemicals in the atmosphere to both modify the weather and for military communications purposes. The military has been using spraying to make cloud formations that create, quote, sky antennas to assist drones and provide other horizon communication. Dennis Kucinich referred me to the military's document, Joint Vision for 2020, that outlines a directed energy program designed, quote, full spectrum dominance of the Earth. The Wright-Patterson scientists pointed to a paper by the United States Air Force entitled Weather as a Public Multiplier, Owning the Weather by 2025. The scientists referred me to patent number 6315213, filed November 13, 2002. The patent abstract specifically states, quote, the polymer is dispersed into the cloud and the wind of the storm agitates the mixture, causing the polymer to absorb the rain. This reaction forms a gelatinous substance which precipitates to the surface below, thus diminishing the cloud's ability to rain, end quote. Caldera explained, quote, with the Earth in a fevered state, the pressure to put on a solar geoengineering ice pack could become irresistible, especially if this ice pack could potentially save millions of lives, end quote. The U.S. government needs to come clean on this top-secret program that's being done without any environmental impact statements. In a democracy, we need full transparency, and the public needs to know what the government knows that justifies this aerial sunscreen spraying. At least Caldera spelled it out. Quote, if current trends in greenhouse gas emissions continue, unprecedented mega droughts may plague much of the western USA, and the tropics may get so hot that widespread crop failures and famines become commonplace. End quote. So there we have it. Now they're coming out of the closet. So when you looked up in the sky and you saw that geoengineering going on up there, yeah, they were doing it, supposedly to help us. There's no open discussion. There's no acknowledgement of it. But they've been doing it for a long time. I believe it's time that we had a complete review of everything the government has sponsored, paid for directly or by private contracts, why they're doing and what the outcome was, and what the health impacts of putting all those chemicals in the air, because everything in the air ultimately comes down to us, and we breathe it in. I'm Gary Noll. That's our program for today. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
But you just don't understand.